We're not doing that. There's no place like Gnome Choke.
We
could. Not this week, not ever again.
We could. Don't you think we should leave it up to the listener?
You're beginning to annoy me.
Well, let Saigons be Saigons.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin, and Ron Elving, welcome back.
It's good to be back. I want to say thank you to my colleagues, Mara Liasson, Don Gagne, for occupying this chair and providing so much valuable information the last 2 weeks. We're going to put a stop to that right now. There's a lot to talk about, though, Ken. Serious issues before the United States Congress.
The death of George Steinbrenner.
The reunion of Levi and Bristol.
Or the financial regulation bill. That's what we really want to talk about.
Well, look, financial regulations are very important. This nation depends on its financial institutions, and we need to re-regulate them after a long period of experimentation with deregulation. The bill has been stalled in the Senate, shockingly enough, since the conference committee came up with a blended version of the House and Senate versions of this enormous piece of legislation, essentially reinventing the regulation of the financial industry.
And they do have the votes to break the filibuster, thanks to three Republicans who have come over, Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, and Scott Brown. And the only one the Democrats lose is Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. But I would have thought that this is the bill that everybody wanted to see passed. I mean, it's not perfect. It's not all-inclusive. It's not going to solve all the problems. It doesn't deal with Fannie and Freddie. But it was something that everybody wanted done, given what happened in 2008.
Yes, and probably even a lot of the people who are voting against it think it's probably a good idea to pass this bill. They just don't want to be part of the political exposure and the political risk that's associated with voting for anything that has to do with Wall Street at this point. When we look at what happened to Bob Bennett in Utah, when we look at what happened to other Republicans who voted for the bailout back in
Bob
the fall of 2008.
Bob Inglis in South Carolina.
And these people went down because they voted essentially to save, to bail out the financial industry at a moment of panic, a la 1929. And they have paid the ultimate political price for having done that at the request of their own Republican president, George W. Bush. So in that climate, in that sort of moment in our politics, it's possible that a guy like Russ Feingold is running for re-election, has a well-funded opponent running hard against him as a kind of anti-establishment candidate, just doesn't feel like he can vote for even a financial re-regulation bill supported by his own president and party.
I'm not sure if the reason for Feingold voting no is that, but it is interesting that all those Republicans who voted for the bailout in 2008, like Bob Bennett, like Bob Inglis in South Carolina, who paid the price in 2010 in the primaries, suddenly saying, look, why? You know, why? I mean, this is the dilemma that the Republican Party faces, that every time they think that maybe we have to take some political risks, they get hammered by
their own party.
Their own party.
This is where the damage is being done to Republicans who have tried to do what they thought was the responsible thing, they themselves thought was the responsible thing. And the problem has come not in general elections, but in their own primaries because of the anti-establishment, anti-Washington, anti-Wall Street feeling in the Republican ranks.
So the Democrats do have the vote for financial regulation, but they don't yet have the vote for extending unemployment insurance.
This is interesting. They can get 60 votes for this enormous and controversial bill with respect to the financial industry, but they can't get 60 votes to extend unemployment benefits. The Republicans have really closed ranks on the issue of saying this is a symbolic vote up or down on deficit expansion, not on unemployment benefits extension. And of course, the Democrats are down one right now from their previous 59 because of the death of Robert C. Byrd. So they need to get somebody into the West Virginia slot.
So that's why what's going to happen on Friday is significant because first of all, we already have two Republicans on board for the extending unemployment benefits.
The two women from Maine.
Exactly. And we have one Democrat, Ben Nelson from Nebraska, who says he won't vote for it. So you still need one more vote to get to 60. And that'll probably be the Democrat who Joe Manchin, the West Virginia governor, names on Friday. Now, Manchin himself wants to run for the seat. It looks like, as we're speaking, there's a special session of the West Virginia State Legislature. They're going to create a special election rather than have it in 2012. They're going to have it in 2010. Manchin will probably announce Monday that he will run, but on Friday, the Democrats will get that seat filled in West Virginia, and they should have enough of the unemployment.
So this also creates kind of a Charlie Crist situation a little bit, like in Florida, where he appointed George Lemieux to fill the seat for a period of time so that he could then run for it himself. He didn't want to appoint himself. The history of governors appointing themselves to the Senate is not a happy one.
The last one was Happy Chandler in 1939. That was the last governor who had himself appointed to the Senate, who was able to win re-election. Everybody else since then has been defeated.
So the cool way to do it in our era is you appoint a placeholder, somebody you can count on to step down.
Ted Kaufman in Delaware.
Ted Kaufman in Delaware, who will step aside after a period of time and not try to hold on to the seat himself.
Well, everything else has been, you know, their buddies. George Lemieux is basically an alter ego of Charlie Crist in Florida. Now, of course, they're not speaking to
former chief of staff,
right.
but now not so happy because, Charlie Crist has left the Republican Party.
And, of course, the reason Ted Kaufman was named in Delaware, because he's Joe Biden's good friend. And he was
again, a former staff member.
And he was going to keep the seat warm for Beau Biden, who ultimately decided not to run for that seat.
Of course, decided not to run for that seat after Mike Castle decided to run for that seat.
And he also had health problems, too.
Another issue hanging fire in the Senate that it looks like it's on its way to fairly easy resolution is the nomination of Elena Kagan to be the new Associate Justice on the United States Supreme Court.
Right. Jeff Sessions, the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, requested and got a one-week delay. I mean, they say they're still unhappy with some of the answers, the non-answers that Elena Kagan gave the Republican senators during the confirmation hearings. But first of all, I think everybody's made up their mind already, and everybody knows that she's going to get very few Republican votes, perhaps even fewer than Sotomayor got last year.
Probably fewer than Sotomayor got last year, but it was a predicted delay. They have the option of asking for a one-week putting off of the vote in the Judiciary Committee. We now expect that vote to happen Tuesday.
The 20th.
And we expect her to be approved by the committee. We expect her to be then debated on the floor of the Senate in subsequent weeks and approved before the Senate goes home in August.
That's the Senate. We've talked about the Senate, but of course, we something to talk about the House. Robert Gibbs kind of said what everybody knew was true, but although it seems to have created a firestorm in Washington. But Robert Gibbs on Meet the Press Sunday said that the House may be in play. You know, there's like enough seats out there that the House is in play.
Is the House in jeopardy? The majority for the Democrats in the House in jeopardy?
I think there are no doubt that there are a lot of seats that will be up, a lot of contested seats. I think people are going to have a choice to make in the fall. But I think there's no doubt there are enough seats in play that could cause Republicans to gain control. There's no doubt about that.
And so many Democrats went ballistic on that, and yet everybody knows that the House could be in play.
I think Democrats in the House feel like they're cannon fodder right now. They feel like the Obama administration assumes that it's going to lose vast numbers of its foot soldiers in the House in November's elections and has been planning around that for a long time, that they sent them out there to pass all the legislation the president wanted, the energy bill, the economic stimulus bill, the health care bill, financial regs bill, and that they did all that. They did it all in 2009, and now they've just been left out there by the Senate coming much more slowly along behind each one of those achievements, and they've been left out there by the Obama administration essentially to take the hit and take the heat for all of it so that theoretically, if it works that way, the Obama administration can then start over again in 2011 with something of a fresh slate or at least a somewhat different political dynamic and move toward its own reelection year in 2012. They feel like cannon fodder.
Well, a lot of people feel that what Robert Gibbs did was basically to play the expectation game. And by saying that the House is in play, if the Republicans fail to make that majority, get the majority, then everybody can say, well, you know, they didn't do the job they were supposed to do.
That's right. If the Democrats say, oh, we don't think they're going to get more than 20 or 25, then they're going to look terrible when the Republicans get more than that, which I think they will. I think 20 or 25 was baked in the cake practically from the beginning of the 111th Congress. And now that we're looking at something 50%, 75%, maybe 100% larger than 20 to 25, that's what the Democrats have to set as the new goal for a successful Republican outing. But again, that makes the average little guy in the House, particularly freshmen, second-termers, people elected in 06 and 08.
Pro-lifers who voted for the health care bill?
People who really exposed themselves on behalf of the Obama agenda and made a difficult political situation, which would have been difficult under any circumstances, much more so, those people feel like they're not getting the love back from the White House, that the White House isn't supporting them, and in fact, the White House is playing games with them.
And one of the House seats that the Republicans would love to pick up in their effort to regain a majority in the House is in Alabama's 2nd Congressional District. Alabama held its runoff primaries this week. Their initial primary was June 1st, but they had a bunch of runoffs. In the 2nd Congressional District, Montgomery City Council member Martha Roby was the Republican Party choice to take on freshman Democrat Bobby Bright. Republicans feel they have a not good shot against that. It's a solid Republican district, although Bobby Bright has done nothing wrong.
It was a solid Republican district when Bobby Bright won it.
That's true. That's true. But it was also a very bad year. I mean, 2008 was not a good year for Republicans. 2010 is thought to be a much better year. Republicans are more hopeful there. Other historic news, perhaps, in Alabama, in the 7th District, Terry Sewell won the Democratic runoff. That's Arthur Davis's seat. Arthur Davis gave up the seat to run for governor and lost in the primary. But Terry Sewell, overwhelmingly Democratic seat. If elected, and she probably will be elected, she'll be the first African-American woman sent to Congress from Alabama. And one more thing about Alabama, just to point out, the Republican establishment figure for governor of Alabama, Bradley Byrne, was clobbered by an outsider in the primary, Robert Bentley. Bentley said he would not take a salary while the unemployment is high in Alabama. And also the Alabama Education Association, which is a
teachers
union, a liberal group, really ran after Bradley Byrne, spent over $2 million in campaign ads attacking him. And in Alabama, there's no registration by party, so it's very possible that even Democrats voted in the runoff to defeat Bradley Byrne. So now Robert Bentley will run against Ron Sparks, who beat Arthur Davis in the primary back in June for the governorship in November.
That kind of ferment among conservatives in Alabama is, in some respects, reminiscent of what we've seen in South Carolina this year. We saw, for example, Bob Inglis badly defeated in his primary.
He got under 30%.
And in the weeks since he lost his runoff and did so poorly, he has had a lot to say about what's going on with the reaction of conservatives and Republicans in his state of South Carolina and elsewhere in the country, and said, caution note, yes, I oppose the Obama agenda. I oppose what the Democrats want to do in Congress. But what is going to be our alternative program? Are we just going to be listening to demagogues? That was the word he used, demagogues. And he has made it clear that he's talking about some of the people in the media, some of the people in the conservative movement.
He mentioned
Glenn Beck in particular, other people at Fox. And he said, that's not the way that we're going to solve the country's problems. That's not going to deal with the national deficit. That's not going to deal with the problems of the economy.
We had Bob Inglis on Talk of the Nation this week, and, you know, we talked about when he was first elected to Congress. I mean, he was considered one of the true revolutionaries of the Republican Party. And he said, you know, my first 6 years in the House, my goal was to stop Bill Clinton and vote against Bill Clinton. And then, of course, he ran for the Senate against Fritz Hollings in 98, lost and was out for 6 years. And he said, when I came back, I decided just running against something, being against something, is not what I want to do in Congress. I want to be for something. And the Republican Party, and he mentioned, you know, he didn't mention in this interview, but he's alluded to Sarah Palin and death panels and things like that, that it's just so much out there that's not true, and it's harmed the Republican Party.
Another thing that's still going on in South Carolina that we've been talking about for weeks now is the phenomenon of Alvin Green, the Democratic nominee for the Senate. He's trying to unseat a Republican senator, Jim DeMint, who is not only very popular in South Carolina and clearly on his way to re-election, but also a rising force in the Republican Party nationally, traveling all over the country, endorsing candidates for the Senate.
Raising money,
looking very much as though he may be preparing to run for leadership there in the Senate, or perhaps make some other kind of national move. So Alvin Green is on a bit of a quixotic mission running against Jim DeMint in South Carolina, but he says he's also running to square the score with the Army, which he thinks mistreated him during his years in the SERP.
And this weekend, Alvin Green will be speaking to the Manning, South Carolina branch of the NAACP, and it'll be interesting to see what he has to say.
The NAACP, of course, much in the news this week because of their resolution condemning elements of the Tea Party for racism.
Right, that's exactly right. And it was basically a unanimous vote. It doesn't take effect until the national board of the NAACP meets in October in Baltimore. But it really got a heated reaction from Tea Party supporters like Sarah Palin. And you knew she was angry because she was typing on her Facebook page. And you always know that, you know, something's up with
right.
When she writes on Facebook. But anyway, basically it didn't say that the Tea Party was racist. It just said there are racist elements in the Tea Party. And first of all, I'm not even exactly sure what the Tea Party is. It seems like it's a conglomeration of stuff that it's not to say that the national Tea Party is racist.
There is no national Tea Party.
Right.
There is scarcely even a statewide Tea Party anywhere in the country. Even in the states where they're most active, in fact, especially in the states where they're most active, there is not a coherent, or perhaps that's not the best word, there is not a clearly centrally organized institution that we could call the Tea Party. There is no chairman of the Tea Party. There are several groups that may call themselves something like that, Tea Party Express, for example. But nobody really speaks for the movement except, in a sense, Sarah Palin. And this is one of the things that makes her relationship with the Tea Party so useful for her, because she can speak for them as though she were the queen of the Tea Party at a particular moment when that works for her and for them, and then she can separate herself from it if there is anything the Tea Party does that may be embarrassing.
And while the Tea Party itself may not be doing things that are embarrassing, there are certainly Tea Party members or people who say they are Tea Party adherents who have done embarrassing things, like shout out racist comments. Emanuel Cleaver, the congressman from Missouri, said he was spat upon after the health care vote.
By people who were identified with the Tea Party.
And
again, in that unofficial sort of way.
Self-identified, right.
That's right.
But there, to be fair here, there are members or leaders or whatever you want to call these people of the Tea Party who have done everything they can to root out these extreme voices, extreme members. And look, there are extreme members everywhere. There are extremists in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. The point is, I think, I'm not sure if the NAACP was condemning the Tea Party as a whole, but the Tea Party supporters certainly took it that way.
While we're criticizing people with respect to this whole discussion, I think there's a shorthanding that goes on in the media that I have certainly participated in, and I think all journalists do, which is the phenomenon of let's let you and him fight. And so if we hear that they're going to have a vote on condemning elements in the Tea Party and the NAACP, we, of course, report that as the NAACP condemns the Tea Party as racist without any of the qualifiers, without any of the finer points of what may have actually been voted on. So I think that there's always a kind of pot boiling that goes on around any issue that has to do with race, and a lot of that is hyped and pumped up and increased by the media.
Well, speaking of race, there is one congressional primary coming up in Tennessee that is clearly about race, and one of the candidates have made it about race from day one. This is in western Tennessee in Memphis, where Steve Cohn, who is white, it's an overwhelmingly African-American district. This is a district that Harold Ford Sr. and Harold Ford Jr.
represented previously
for years, mm-hmm. until Cohn won it in 2006 when Harold Ford left to run for the Senate. So anyway, Steve Cohn has battled in every election in 2006 and 2008, and this one as well, by African-American ministers who said that a white person should not be representing this district. And President Obama himself weighed into this race. He didn't talk about race, but he did talk about that Steve Cohn has fought for the Obama agenda, and I endorse him for another term, which set off Willie Herenton, the former mayor of Memphis, who's running against Steve Cohn in the primary. He said that Obama had no business getting involved in this.
I'll bet he felt that way very strongly. Do you think the mayor would have felt the same way if Obama had endorsed him over Steve Cohn?
Well, actually, interesting, but that's true. But President Obama has made a point of never opposing any incumbent. We saw this with Steve Cohn in Tennessee. We saw that with Michael Bennett in Colorado, even though Bill Clinton went with Romanoff. Basically, the White House is standing behind every Democratic incumbent.
Well, and Arlen Specter in Pennsylvania, right, who was even a party-switching incumbent. It was clearly a matter of saying, I want you people's votes while we're here in the 111th Congress, and the very least I can do is support you against intra-party challengers in the primaries, and that they have done. And since you bring up Colorado, Ken, a rather interesting development there for Scott McGinnis in his gubernatorial campaign.
Well, this guy was a former congressman who left, I guess, in 2004, thereabouts. He was the front runner for the Republican gubernatorial nomination. He looks like he's in big trouble. A series of essays that he ostensibly wrote that he got paid $300,000 for, as it turned out, were basically plagiarized from a Colorado State Supreme Court justice.
It looks like he did something of a cut-and-paste job on a report that he was doing for a family foundation, and or that perhaps he jobbed it out to somebody else to do it and didn't really check their work see whether or not it was original.
He blamed it on a research assistant who in turn said, oh, no, this was Scott's job.
This was Scott's work, yeah. That was not pretty either, no. So the entire picture adds up to him looking like something other than the distinguished former congressman returning and offering his services to the fine people of Colorado.
I think, for all the talk about the Republicans are on the march back in Colorado, and they still have a chance of winning the Senate seat, they probably won't rescue that governorship. John Hickenlooper, the mayor of Denver, very popular, looks like he's on his way to winning that seat.
Well, all right, that's what we know about Scott McGinnis and John Hickenlooper. And speaking of fun couples, up in Alaska, love blooms again among the young.
I presume you're not talking about Alaska Congressman Don Young.
No, maybe, no, I'm not.
You're talking about
the Young.
Bristol Palin and Levi Johnston together again.
It kind of warms the cockles, doesn't it, just a little bit, to think that love can bloom again.
Well, somebody who said some terrible things about his future mother-in-law, who may be...
And whose future mother-in-law has said some fairly terrible things about him. But it's not the mother-in-law and Levi Johnston who are getting married. It's Bristol. She is setting her own course. She is saying to Mama Grizzly, maybe I, the cub, know where I want to go.
And one thing to note, the passing of George Steinbrenner. Interesting, his big political story with George Steinbrenner is that the illegal money he gave to Richard Nixon in 1972, and he was pardoned by another Republican, Ronald Reagan, and yet, every time the Yankees won the World Series 7 times under George Steinbrenner's rule, it was under a Democratic president. And the 4 times the Yankees lost were under Republican presidents. What does that mean, Ron Elving?
I think that means that that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
The kids in Bristol are sharp at the pistol when they do the Bristol. Really something when the joint is jumping when they do the Bristol stuff.
Oh, oh, the sound's spinning, he'll be Friday night. They dance the greatest and they do right.
When they do
the Bristol stomp. Who sung it?
Oh,
we could put that Bristol stomp.
It wasn't Ronnie and the Juniors.
No. The Dovells.
The Dovells. Okay.